Mr. Hayward, reel 9. We got to the point where we were at Rudston with the 2nd Fife and 4 Fire near Bridlington, and the Crusaders have been replaced by Shermans. But you also spent some time, besides driving the supply vehicles, driving Bren gun carriers, or Bren carriers. What do you remember of that?
Yes, that's interesting, because the regiment in Bridlington obviously still possess some Bren gun carriers. To my memory, they probably had about half a dozen. And these must have been left over from perhaps days when they were experimenting with reconnaissance vehicles. And I knew that at Bridlington they had these small armoured cars, which were not on tracks, they were on wheels, fairly hefty wheels. But they were sort of hexagonal shaped vehicles. I believe they were Daimlers. I think they, the nickname was Dingoes or something like that. But anyway, they had these armoured cars, because I remember seeing them coming back from exercises with chaps in, sitting in there with their faces all plastered with dust and mud, and all around their goggles that they wore. So they obviously exercised with them fully open at the top. But anyway, these Bren gun carriers must have become redundant, and as it was still pre-Normandy days, they must have decided that these Bren gun carriers could be made use of elsewhere. And I was one of the lucky people delegated to drive one of these Bren gun carriers back to Chilwell Ordnance Depot in Nottinghamshire via Doncaster Racecourse. I mentioned Doncaster Racecourse because we didn't do the journey all in one day. We took the Bren as far as Doncaster Racecourse, and then on to Chilwell. I would assume that an ordinary transport vehicle accompanied us so that we could be taken back to Bridlington afterwards. That part I don't remember, but I certainly don't remember going back to Bridlington by train, so it must have been a vehicle. But that journey was great fun. We had really good fun driving these Brens on the roads, which were fairly clear of other traffic, so we could disport ourselves and put them through their paces. And we could, as I said in my narrative, could make them spin like tops when you got the right conditions. If there was a nice camber on the road and you had to do a sharp turn somewhere, you could turn the wheel, give it a good tug, and the carrier would stop dead on one side, on one track, and just spin because of the speed you were doing. And as there was plenty of room, there was no danger. And we were all doing that one by one as we turned off in some village or other. And then on to the racecourse, where we slept in sort of makeshift beds underneath the stands, which was in regular use as a transit camp. The journey to Chilwell I don't remember much about, except possibly coming back in the lorry. I do remember seeing for the first time there were some nodding donkeys, those oil wells with the rocking shafts like a beam engine pumping the oil, which was quite an interesting sight. So that was the end of the Bren gun episode.
Now, while you were there, you were on a couple of exercises. During these exercises, were you still with the MT, with the workshop, or?
Yes, I must have been. I must have been with the workshop still, because I hadn't been delegated any specific regular duty, like a tank crew or anything, and. I do remember being used occasionally by the workshop team, and but when these exercises came up, they just picked on anybody to do a specific job doing the exercise. And the first one that you mentioned, Blackcock, I was obviously delegated to drive a petrol wagon. And in that particular year, we were still using the square petrol cans, which contained probably about 4 gallons. They were very flimsy. They were made of thin sheet metal, and they very easily got damaged. So there was always a danger of a leak somewhere of petrol from those cans. Especially if the lorry, you know, jolted and they moved around on the back, they could cannon into each other and then pierce. They usually got damaged as a joint. One of the joints, I think some of these cans were soldered, but they certainly got damaged very easily, so there's always that danger of a leak. But anyway, during this exercise, they were obviously practicing night manoeuvres. And so in this exercise, we were going through a wood in column, and it was really dark. Not only because of the wood, but it was a dark night, which later turned to rain, so it must have been very cloudy. And this track through the woods obviously had a steep camber on each side. There was probably a ditch there, I'd guess. But anyway, because of the visibility being so poor, and we were told not to use any lights at all, we had great difficulty in even seeing the vehicle in front. So eventually I found the lorry tilting over to the left, and I had a passenger, and at the extreme point he got so alarmed he jumped out because it was tilting quite dangerously, almost to the rocking point. So he jumped out, I don't blame him, and I came to a stop then and got out myself, and there was probably a sergeant moving around the column. Obviously other people had got into difficulties and he was sorting them out. So he came and sorted me out, guiding me, possibly with a pencil torch or something. He was guiding me in the direction I should take to get the vehicle back on an even keel, which I did. It was rather a hair-raising operation because with it being on the rocking point, I had to be very careful that I didn't turn suddenly. It had to be a very gradual process to ease it out of this dangerous position. But later on in the night it started raining and I was given a guard duty to do when we got into this formation area. And still in the woods. And so we all stretched out on our ground sheets waiting for our turn of guard duty, wrapped up in blankets. And then it started to rain, and I woke up realising that rain was coming down on my face, but by that time I felt my blankets, they were soaking wet, and it was near time for my turn of duty, so I just got up and rolled up the blankets and put them in a truck, probably my truck, When we were not on guard duty, we just sat in the cabs and waited for morning. When morning came, we were allowed to light huge bonfires and dry everything out. And that was the very first time that I'd known them issue the run ration, which was a sort of a small, like a tablespoonful of rum put into your enamel mug. And everybody got their ration. And that probably did the trick, kept us free of colds and chills.
Anything else during Black Cock?
No, I think once morning came and we dried out, I think one by one each unit dispersed back to camp. I don't remember doing anything much after that.
Do you remember the trips up to Scotland?
Yes. I don't remember taking a lorry up to Scotland, but I do remember train journeys up to Scotland via the famous Sutherland Carlisle line. because I do remember there was snow about as we went through that famous area, Garsdale, I think they call it, and the Dent Valley Viaduct up in that very hilly region. There was certainly snow about, and of course it was a steam engine. But we were taken by a rail to, I would imagine, somewhere like Dumfries, and then by lorry to wherever we were staying. You see, there was firing practice going on in Kirkcudbrightshire. That was one reason for going to Scotland. And on that particular occasion, I was involved with transport. So I arrived there by train, but obviously vehicles were already there, and I was delegated to use a vehicle for conveying people about, probably from the railway station, backwards and forwards, and also to take them on the evening jaunts for their entertainment in Kirkcudbright. I don't think we used Dumfries as a place of entertainment. I don't remember going in.
So was this a firing range exercise or an exercise, or what was it?
There was a tank firing range there, and I believe from my memories of geography, I believe Kirkcudbrightshire is the nearest point to England, overlooking the Solway Firth. Not sure. But anyway, it looked out over the sea. The opposing side would be somewhere like Lancaster, I suppose, Lancashire, North Lancashire, Morecambe Bay, and that sort of thing.
You don't know the name of the range?
The range, good question. Now, I did know it. It was some farm.
Oh, we can look in the it'll be in the war directory. So you were just driving.
Driving a 3-ton lorry.
So you didn't actually go on the range yourself.
I didn't see the range. No, I didn't get near that. It was a we were billeted at a farm in the stables and hay lofts, etc. And it was a pretty wet area, but not unpleasant. The countryside was quite lovely there, and. I suppose I would be there for a few days. It was an operation, I would imagine, that was taken in turns. But as each squadron did their firing practice, their place was taken by another one, and they shunted around. So the whole regiment wasn't there at once. It was taken in stages.
Now, another thing is Exercise Eagle. Now, on this one, you were put in as co-driver of a tank. Now, what was the background to this? Was that just to give you experience, or what was it?
I imagine it was just to plug a gap, you know, that they needed a crew for this tank. Perhaps they didn't have enough people, so I was picked on to go in as co-driver in this Sherman tank. And
Had you had any experience at all before that?
Only at Catterick. Only at Catterick of being in a tank in a training regiment.
So no real relevant experience at the time?
No.
And what was your first impression of being in this showroom?
Oh, I probably found it very exciting to be given the opportunity to be part of a tank crew. Not knowing that I might eventually become one, but for the purpose of the exercise, I expect I found it quite exciting.
What was the job of co-driver then?
The job of co-driver was to be part of the crew receiving messages over the intercom via headphones. And to act on those messages if necessary, such as firing the machine gun which you were equipped with in front of you, what they called the hull gun, I think, or the bow gun, sometimes they call it the bow gun, like the bows of a ship, the bows of a ship.
And what that was the browning, was it?
Yes.
Could you describe it, the browning then?
Yes, it was a very neat gun. I'm not sure what country it emanated from, whether it was British or USA, I don't know. I think it might have been American. But it was very neat, made of the usual gun metal, and box-shaped. Most of it was box-shaped. The sort of tail end part was box-shaped with a kind of a pistol grip into it. And the front had the usual barrel sticking out of the tank on the exterior. But it was mounted on a heavy spring, and I wasn't really aware of that at the time. I hadn't had any practice in firing it. And strangely enough, we were all equipped with live ammunition. And this had to be fed in a belt on a belt.
The belt came out of a box, or?
Yes, it was in a metal box. And you fed it through. That was fairly easily done.
And you could aim the brown, could you aim it just up and down, or was it from side to side as well?
Oh, yes, you could traverse it from side to side to a limited extent, and up and down.
And how could you see?
And you had to see via a periscope. Unless you had your hatch lid open. If your lid was open, then you could raise your seat by a lever. You could raise it up so that your head was sticking out and you could see what was going on. So you didn't use... I don't remember using any sights on the gun. I don't think that was possible because of the enclosed nature of the tank. You had to fire by looking through the periscope if you were enclosed, and following the course of the tracer bullets. So wherever the tracer bullets went, you knew you were getting near the target.
And I believe you had a bit of an accident with the...
Yes, I'm afraid I did. I suppose with all these guard duties that we got, it was inevitable that if we had a night exercise, some of us were feeling pretty tired at times, and a lot of us did doze off. And that was certainly one of my habits, was to doze off if nothing much was happening. And as far as I recall, the tank was just rumbling along very slowly in the dark. And at intervals, it would come to a halt, and nothing would happen. So eventually, I must have dozed off, dutifully holding the rounding gun by the trigger, and no doubt the safety catch was off, so that I could fire if somebody said I had to. After all, it was only simulated exercises, but I suppose on the open ground, in daylight, they would have been given targets to fire at. Not having been trained as tank crew, never having been on an exercise before, I didn't know how far I was expected to go with this simulation. So I was holding the trigger with everything all ready and dozed off. And what I imagine happened was that the strong spring reasserted itself while I was dozing off and was pulling on my trigger hand, so that eventually the tension caused my finger to actually press the trigger, because the gun was steadily dropping down as I dozed off, and some bullets got fired, I would think at a guess about 10 or a dozen, before I worked with a start and, you know, half realised what had happened. Everything happened suddenly there, and I heard an officer coming down the column asking questions, and when he came to me, he asked me, "Did I hear any shots fired?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Have you any idea where they came from?" I said, "Well, somewhere very close." And, you know, I think it was at that point I realised it was me. And after it had gone by, I felt on the floor, and there were some empty cartridges from the gun, and I hastily grabbed them up and put them behind the front shaft, which was a messy place because at various stages the tanks had been waterproofed, and any amount of that black caustic stuff had been shoved into these crevices where any fault in the welding might lie, where water could come in when they went in the sea. So I just stuffed them down into that space, into that gunge, and hoped for the best. Well, next day nothing was said about it, and I think the incident was just forgotten. Everybody was obviously far too tired to bother, and were anxious to get back.
Anything else about Exercise Eagle?
I think Exercise Eagle was treated as a bit more energetic than the other one. As far as the tanks were concerned, I might even have been taken out of that exercise, not because of the incident, but it may be that when daylight came, they switched the crews around a bit and then went off on some other part of the exercise. Memory is not very good as to the exact details, but certainly to individual soldiers, a lot of these exercises were very boring because they didn't know what was going on or what they were intended to do or achieve. So they would have some kind of a debriefing afterwards, I expect.
Now, anything else about, this is really while you were based at Rudston. Anything else about Rudston before you? I think in March you moved up to 44. You moved to Aldershot.
Yes. Yeah. There was just that waterproofing incident you mentioned. Again, that must have been another train journey, or alternatively, they might have seized the opportunity while I was up there with the firing crews to take me off for a day to do a waterproofing exercise with others. Because over somewhere near Irving, which wasn't too far away from Kirkcudbury, up near Irving they had some sort of estuary where conditions were reasonably good. The underwater surface was good enough to drive vehicles into. And
did you waterproof the tank first before these tests? Obviously, but did you do it?
No, somebody. This was before we got involved in waterproofing ourselves. Other people obviously had been doing the vehicles that we used for practice. They were already done. So we merely were going through the motions of driving a vehicle into the water and out again. And that was quite exciting because the weather was pretty wild at the time and the water was quite choppy. And I had the advantage that I'd seen other people driving in and out, and had seen one or two come to grief, and had been told that was because they hadn't kept their foot on the accelerator. They got a bit scared at some point and eased off, and then at that point the engine sucks in water, apparently. You've got to keep the engine going to keep the water, keep the exhaust pushing the water away. So some did come to grief, but I managed my trip all right. That was okay. I was quite pleased with that. No problem.
So that, anything else?
No, I think that's, apart from the usual frolics going for fish and chips down in the town at Bridlington, the entertainment side.
How did you get on with the Yorkshire folks?
Oh, they were fine, yes. And Ron Cox speaks in very glowing terms.
What about Yorkshire? I mean, not so much Ron, what you thought?
Well, being of Yorkshire birth myself and having Yorkshire relatives, there are still many relations alive at that time in the Bradford area. So I found Yorkshire a very pleasant place to be, and the Yorkshire folk were kind and even generous, I suppose, up to a point, with wartime conditions. And I enjoyed being in Yorkshire because I had opportunities to go on short leaves down to Bradford to go down to Buckinghamshire when my parents were almost too long. But for a short leave, Bradford was possible because I could get some lifts on Norris down the Great North Road. A lot of them were heading for the Leeds Bradford area.
So the next thing would be this move to Aldershot in March, I think it is, 44.
Yes. Yes, the tanks were obviously delivered by rail. My memory is a bit poor on how I got to Aldershot. I suppose a lot of us could have gone by train. Yes, that's highly possible. If there was a mass move, too many for the regimental transport, then we would go by train. So that's highly probable that we went down to Aldershot by train, and the vehicles were moved by whoever it was available.
Do you know which barracks you went into, or camp at Aldershot?
Yes, it is down in the account, the name of it. I've just forgotten it.
Is it Warburg?
Warburg, that's it. Yes,
and it is that one, because in the account it just says it might be.
Ah, well, still Burnley in his account, he mentions it quite clearly. Yes, Warburg. So I wouldn't swear to that, but I take his writings as gospel, that he knew what he was talking about.
And what was the barracks like?
Barracks were 19th century style cavalry barracks. They were very, very strongly built, and everything about them was massive. Everything was heavy, and you can imagine that they were designed for very strong men, very beefy soldiers of the 19th century days. But in other ways, the barracks were very gloomy places. They were very, very, very geared to military operations, discipline, and so on. And not a very pleasant place to be, because you were surrounded on all sides by military. And I've always, whenever I can, I've always avoided all the shot if I have to travel in that direction, because I found it a very uninteresting place, because it is just a military town, and it's full of everything that goes with it. And when you're in the army, I suppose you want to get away from that sort of thing. But while I was down there, I don't remember going out much. I think I found the town a bit dull. I think our movements out of the camp were fairly restricted at the time, as it was getting near the invasion.
Was there much secrecy about this? I mean, were you aware of any secrecy about the Second Front, any possible date or destination? Not that you'd know, but...
No, we didn't know, but we did have that feeling that things were getting a bit secretive, that we were tending to be muffled a bit, or muzzled. Must not sort of say too much, careless talk and all that sort of thing. So they did restrict the leave and going out business, although other people talk of going out, so there must have been some relaxation at times.